We have been talking for the last, gosh, 6-7 weeks now. We went through the Lord's Prayer, and we kind of put it all together, and then last week we talked a little bit more about applying all the things that we learned in the Lord's Prayer. But there is one thing that kind of, I think, needs another look. And this is the problem of evil. And it is a problem, right? Evil in the Aramaic, and the way that we looked at it in the Lord's Prayer, has a very specific meaning to the Hebrew mind. And when God says to, or when we ask the Father to deliver us from evil, what we're asking Him to do is to deliver us from anything that would keep us from the ability to function as we are designed to function. In other words, evil in the Aramaic mindset means unripeness. It means immaturity. It means the inability to function the way that we're supposed to function. And this is expected in a collective society. When you think about the ancient Hebrews, they were a nomadic people. And the structure of their family, the structure of their tribes, was their means of survival. Everyone had a role to play. And the way that those roles were played and the effectiveness to which those roles were played determined the effectiveness or the ability of the tribe and the nation to survive. So these things were absolutely essential. So any behavior that benefited the group, benefited the tribe, was taba, was good. Any behavior that didn't was bisha, was evil. Got that? Any behavior that was ripe and ready at the right place at the right time was what was considered good because it contributed to the survival of the group. So that makes perfect sense. Not only that, it gives us a beautiful picture of the way God looks at each one of us. No matter how unlovely our behavior may be, no matter how unlovely our lives may be, God is always looking at us as the unripe one, the one within whom the seeds of ripeness are always present. And so there's always that sense of God seeing through the behavior, seeing through whatever we've gotten ourselves into, seeing through how unmanageable our lives have become to the person that we could be. You know, the taba person, the person who is in the right place at the right time. It's a beautiful way to have God looking at us. And then it's a beautiful way for us to look at each other. No matter how irritated we become with whomever we're with, if we can look beyond that and see the seeds of taba, see the seeds of ripeness and readiness, it helps us to be able to connect, to have a relationship where one wasn't possible before because all we saw was the behavior that drives us crazy or the behavior that hurts us. Having said all of that, though, what do you do with the truly heinous evil that we experience in life? I mean, does an idea of ripeness and unripeness in terms of evil really wash when we're talking about what you might have all experienced in life? The traumas in your youth. I mean, some of you here, either you yourselves or someone you know, has probably experienced some sort of child molestation, some sort of sexual abuse, perhaps rape, perhaps some sort of domestic violence that absolutely left you scarred, left them scarred. How do you deal with that? How do you reconcile that in just this idea of ripeness and unripeness? There seems to be levels of things going on here, doesn't there? I just got a call 2 nights ago from a friend of mine that I've known for years and years now. And he is in the 8th year of a marriage that is just so absolutely devastating and difficult. And his wife is one of those people. She was raped as a child. She was abused as a child. Her mother committed suicide. An aunt committed suicide. I mean, no child gets out of that kind of situation undamaged. Her ability to have a relationship with a man right now is so compromised that you almost can't blame her. But on the other hand, how do you live with her? What do you do? What does he do? After 8 years of trying, how does he put all this together? Yes, we can understand. We can see where the unripeness comes from. But what do we do with the behavior? Does it mean that we're supposed to just sit there and be part of the blast zone as all of this devastation and continued dysfunction goes on? These are difficult decisions. I had another person call me and tell me just a couple nights ago that her 78-year-old mother and her husband have had a difficult marriage as well, but they had a fight, I guess, a couple nights ago somewhere out, and he got so angry he just left her there. She's 78. She has trouble walking. She has trouble hearing. How do you do that? You know, there is a level of immaturity and thoughtlessness there. And as I was thinking about that, I'm saying, how can anyone just leave their elderly wife somewhere? You know, the daughter and the son-in-law had to go pick her up and take her to a hotel for the night. But then you stop and think, well, but he didn't shoot her. He didn't cut her up into little pieces and they found her all over the county. You know, he didn't bury her alive. I mean, think about the things that you read about in the newspaper. There is a whole complete different class to that kind of evil, that kind of dysfunction, that kind of harmful behavior that just doesn't seem to be covered by this idea of ripeness and unripeness now, does it? When you read the headlines, when you hear about minors being trapped and rescuers being killed as they try to rescue those who are trapped, when you read about the war atrocities that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and what is happening in some countries, how do you reconcile this stuff? You know, the evil that we have to live through in life, either personally or by extension, calls all our faith into question. Because it calls who God is into question. I mean, if he's in charge of all this stuff, if he created all this stuff, then where is he? What's going on here? How can a good God, a loving God, allow this to happen? The classic question, isn't it? But it also calls into question our way of looking at life and our way of relating to each other. Because how do we deal with each other when this kind of evil behavior is being perpetrated on us and on others? This is what we have to start taking a look at. The Aramaic, interestingly, has another concept to this ripe, unripe part. You can be unripe in the sense of being immature and not yet having gotten ready to be able to act effectively and lovingly in relationships. Or there's also the idea of being rotten, that you have passed the point of being mature. Or maybe you went right from unripe to rotten. I don't know. That's also possible, I suppose. But the idea is, yes, you are way past this. You are now like a rotting piece of fruit, unusable, unable to be eaten to give nutrition and sustenance and to perform to your design specifications. But you can wait for something that's unripe to ripen. What do you do with something that's already rotten? Can the rotten fruit ever be made ripe and sweet again? Well, yes, it can. How? You got to let it completely rot, completely dry out. And then you go and you pick those seeds up and you plant them. And then you grow new fruit. And really, that's all Jesus is telling us to do, isn't it? To die to self, to become born again, is to let the rottenness play through our lives, to fall off, to dry up, and then those seeds to be replanted. This is part of the cycle of Aramaic and Hebrew thought. But still, it leaves us with the question of how do we deal with the evil that we encounter in life? And it seems to me that there's two responses to this. And maybe in our own cultural, social context, we can talk about it as liberal and conservative, because we hear that all the time, don't we? You know, liberal and conservative, i.e. maybe permissive and a legal response to this sort of thing. Or to put it in its most basic terms, maybe, let's talk about a compassionate and a merciful approach as compared to an approach centered in justice. So we've got mercy and compassion on one side, and we've got justice on the other side. We've got permissiveness within our society, within family groups or any institution, and then we've got a more legal approach. So when we talk about a liberal in our society, often we're talking about a person who is more focused on rehabilitation than on punishment. One that is using as a primary method of operation compassion and mercy. But the problem is when you take that out into the marketplace, when you try to legislate compassion, what happens? You completely obliterate justice. And without justice, you don't have the basic framework within which society operates. On the other hand, the conservative is typically one who's based in law, right? The rule of law. We must secure our borders. We must enforce our laws. And that's absolutely true for the good of the group, for the good of society as a whole. Laws must be enforced. And there must be some sort of consequences for the behavior that we commit, whether it's good or whether it's bad. But what happens when you take that too far? What happens is that you no longer see a person as a person, but simply as a member of an offending group. And then the law, the letter of the law, becomes the way that we deal with everybody, regardless of who they are. And probably the ultimate expression of this are these zero tolerance policies, which just drive me crazy. You know, what good is a zero tolerance policy that never takes into account any of the individual circumstances of a case? We end up with such absurdities as a third grader being suspended from school because they brought a water pistol in their backpack, or one whose mommy put a little plastic knife to spread peanut butter on a cracker, and they're out because there's a zero tolerance policy on guns and weapons in the school. You know, common sense and compassion never flows from law. Only law flows from law, and we need to know the difference. And in order to do that, we have to see that Jesus was trying to bring us into a balanced approach, one that takes a discerning attitude between the micro and the macro. And what do I mean by that? Micro is anything that's dealing with an individual or dealing with a one-on-one situation. So you and another person, the relationship that you have is a micro relationship. A macro relationship is three or more. You as parents, you always know that usually two kids can play pretty well together, but you add the third one and you almost always have a fight. The rules change between the micro and the macro. When you've got a group, the dynamics are different. And the way that you deal with that group is different than the way that you're going to deal with a one-on-one relationship. And if you don't get that, if you don't understand the difference between the two, you are forever going to be caught in the loop that we're in as a society right now. Because the basic mode of operation in the macro has got to be justice. The scales have to be balanced, right? There has to be a reasoned approach to equality in order for things to be fair. Every child, that's not fair. They have an innate sense of what fairness is. And if you don't make it fair within the group disintegrates. The group breaks down. The group will not survive. But when you move to a one-on-one relationship in the micro, the basic mode of operation has to be compassion. It has to be mercy. It has to go beyond the letter of the law in order to become loving, in order for there to be kingdom. So the mistake that liberals make is to try to take compassion into the macro, and thereby they lose justice. And the mistake the conservatives make is try to take justice into the micro and thereby lose the compassion and the mercy. We have to understand that we need both in operation in their proper place, in their proper venue, in order for everything to be workable. But the upshot is, and kind of the twist to the story is that if everybody in the micro would really practice mercy and compassion, kingdom would be instilled, which would then fulfill the law. The law will never create kingdom, but kingdom always fulfills the law. Because the law, within kingdom, the law becomes a subset. When we are really operating in love and compassion and mercy, we are automatically following law. But when we're following law, we're not necessarily practicing mercy and compassion. And this is what Jesus was trying to tell us. You know, the Hebrew word chesed, which is really the ultimate of all of this, this idea of mercy and compassion, means loving kindness. And that's the way that you usually will see it translated in the Old Testament. But really what it encompasses is a tender fondness or an affection, a protectiveness, a graciousness, and a willingness to favor. All of that is contained in this word chesed. And here's the most important thing to remember. Compassion is not just. and justice is not compassionate. Compassion deliberately unbalances the scale of justice in order to favor the beloved, right? That's exactly what it's all about. To give someone what they don't deserve. To rain on them whatever you have to rain, whether they deserve it or not. That's compassion. That's mercy. Not justice. But we need both. Justice must be maintained in order for the group to survive. But compassion must be maintained in order for kingdom to survive. And once we establish kingdom, guess what? We get both. And that's what Jesus was trying to tell us. And when we get back to the Aramaic thoughts on all of this, this is what the Hebrew law was all about. The purpose of the Hebrew law wasn't simply to enforce rules. The purpose of the Hebrew law was to preserve life. And to preserve life by preserving the family, which in Hebrew understanding was the entire nation. It was the tribe. It was the extended family. The only way to preserve that was to follow certain rules, because somebody is always going to act outside of compassion and mercy. Someone is always going to be unripe. And so the rules bring it in and guarantees the survival of the group. And beyond that, to instill God's way of life in each one of us so that we can live it personally. And the law also, by sustaining the group, gives each individual the space, the time, the opportunity to engage in kingdom, to understand what this is all about. Without that umbrella, without that shelter within which to work, how do we ever get to the point where we learn about compassion and mercy? Jesus had a lot to say about this. And he was always trying to maintain the balance between the micro and the macro, between justice and mercy and compassion. Listen to a couple of these sayings and see how they work. You remember in Matthew 26 where a woman comes up to Jesus and pours a very expensive jar of perfume on him and anoints him. And she's weeping and she's wiping away the oil with her hair. And the disciples, Jesus' followers, become very indignant. And one of them comes out with, "Why did you waste this oil? It was very expensive. It could have been sold and the proceeds given to the poor." And what does Jesus say? He says, "You will always have the poor with you." Now, what kind of a sensitive comment is that for Jesus to make, huh? You're just always going to have the poor with you. But what's the next line that he says? "But you will not always have me." See, what he's doing is he's making a code switch. You heard code switching before? When you have to switch between two rule codes back and forth. Children have to do this when they live during a divorce, when they have to go to the father's house maybe, and he's got one set of rules, and the mother's house, and they have to try to code switch. We have to try to code switch between the micro and the macro. So Jesus first is making a macro statement. Yes, in the macro. Yes, in the large group. Yes, throughout history, there will always be haves and have-nots. There's nothing you can do to change that. But in the micro, this act of love by this woman is the most important thing that just occurred. It's not going to change the face of the macro truth that we are always going to have poor, whether or not she pours this bottle out or sells it and gives it to the poor. That's not the issue. The issue is that right now, between her and me, this is the exchange that needed to take place. We have to see that both are in operation. This doesn't mean we give up on the poor. We deal with each person with their need as we meet them in the micro. That's what Jesus is trying to tell us. Another time in Matthew 22, a group of Pharisees and Sadducees try to trick him, you know, by saying, "Is it proper that we should pay our taxes to Caesar?" Well, understand that the Roman government was very oppressive, cruel, heinous, you know, practicing what we would see as an unlawful occupation. Should we be supporting that government that is doing this to us? Is that right? Is that moral? And beyond that, you know, in the nationalistic fervor of Jesus' time, you know, is this something that we should be doing rather than trying to find our own independence? And Jesus says, "Show me a coin whose likeness is on it." And then he says, "Well, then give to Caesar that which is Caesar's." Well, that would seem to be saying that he's caving in. But then in the next statement, he says, "But then give to God what is God's." Again, the code switch. First, the macro statement. Within the macro, You need to sometimes bow to the powers that be. But that has nothing to do with the internal relationships, the micro relationships that you can create within any circumstances that you find yourself. Even if you're in Auschwitz during World War II, or if you're in occupied Judea during the first century Roman times, whatever situation you find yourself in, you can always give to Caesar that which is Caesar's and then turn around and still give to God that which is God's. Jesus is trying to show us the balance between the two. A young man comes up to him and says, what do I need to do to obtain eternal life? And Jesus says, well, follow the law. He says, I've done this since my youth. That's the macro statement. Then he says, one thing more when he presses him. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Does that mean that every single one of us always needs to sell everything we have and give it to the poor? Then we'd all be poor. And who's going to support us? That's not what Jesus is after here. The last thing that this young man was holding on to, clinging to, and would not let go of was his wealth. And in order for him to truly experience kingdom, that's what he needed to do in the micro, not in the macro. Code switching. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also, he says in Matthew 5. How fair is that? Someone sues you and you're supposed to go beyond the judgment and give him everything that you have to the point, based on their the dress standards of that day, that would leave you naked in the street if you gave your outer coat and your inner tunic. There was nothing on underneath that. So Jesus is making a very, very strong statement here. But what he's trying to tell you is that there is an attitude in the micro that goes beyond the mere letter of the law. And if we will have that attitude, going beyond the law, going beyond 100% within our micro relationships, amazing things will happen. Attitudes will be changed. You can end up not even going to court in the first place. You can obviate the need for the law if you will simply have this attitude to begin with. This is what Jesus is trying to say. Everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. So if you're just angry in your mind, you're supposed to get a legal judgment against that. It's the same message as before. The anger that we have is what leads us to the eventual acting out of that anger in some way that will break the law. Nip it in the bud. Stop it here. In the micro, go beyond what you think you are legally obligated to do. And then finally he says, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Once again, macro and micro stuff here. Are we supposed to resist an evil person ever? Well, of course we are. When we see an innocent being attacked, aren't we supposed to do something about it? Aren't we supposed to preserve that life? Yes, we are. But what Jesus is talking about here is something else. He's talking about don't return evil for evil. Don't get into a tit-for-tat sort of relationship on a one-to-one basis where someone does something to you and your reaction is to get revenge on them and to return in kind, what he's talking about here. But he's saying, don't respond that way. Basically, what you're going to do is to heap those coals on his head that we see in the image in Proverbs. And basically, you destroy your enemies by turning them into friends in the micro. But Jesus is not talking about pacifism here. There are times when force is absolutely necessary and the morally right course. But in the micro, we have another choice. Basically, Jesus is telling us that the letter of the law means nothing in terms of kingdom, but kingdom always fulfills the law. So seek first the kingdom, right? Matthew 6:33. If we will do that first, then everything else is going to come as a result of that. One of the things that it's hard for us to remember, because of the way we think about evil, we tend to think about evil as the behavior. But in Hebrew thinking, the behavior is not the evil. The behavior is either harmful or it's not. Therefore, it's either taba or bisha, good or bad. But the behavior is not what's at issue. The evil is the state of the person. If they are living in separation, if they are living in fear, they are living in an evil state. And out of that state always flows harmful behavior. Always. You know, Jesus said, you'll know the tree by its fruit. You know, a certain kind of tree always gives the same kind of fruit. A person living in an evil place that is unripe, that is unready, that is simply in fear and separation and anger and jealousy and any of those other negative emotions is always going to create harmful behavior and harmful effects in everyone else. And to make that distinction is helpful because the evil person is always a person who is living in that kind of pain. They're living in pain. They're living in hell. Gehenna, outer darkness, everything that Jesus talked about. That's the state the person is always in. And from that state comes nothing good. Or at least nothing good on a repeatable basis, maybe randomly. You know, even a broken clock is right twice a day, that sort of thing. But to get repeatable results, we need to move from that place of fear and separation into a place of connection, from evil into a place of good. But what about God's role in all of this? This is the second piece. Hopefully we can start to deal with evil in terms of each other by distinguishing between micro and macro. But what about God? And we've still got to deal with God here. What's his role in all of this? And why isn't he regulating these things a little bit better? You know, there's a whole branch of theology and philosophy called theodicy. Any of you familiar with that? It is a whole branch of thinking that deals specifically with this problem of evil in relation to God's nature and attributes. And the basic line goes something like this. If God is all-powerful, okay, everybody agree with that? If God is all-powerful, if God is all-good, benevolent, everybody okay with that? And evil exists, then one of the first two cannot be true, right? Because either God allows the evil and he's not all good, or he is unable to stop the evil and he's not all powerful. Does that make sense? That is the problem of evil classically stated. That's the how can a loving and good God allow this to happen stated in another way. And philosophers have spent, since the beginning of time, pretty much trying to figure out how this all works. And if you want to go online, you can find stacks of reasons to try to justify how this all works. In fact, that's what theodicy means. It literally means God's justice in Greek. But really what it's talking about is justifying God in relationship to the existence of evil. And so all of this stuff is out there, trying to figure out how all this stuff works. How do the Hebrews feel about it? How would Jesus have felt about this? What was his view of this whole thing? First of all, the Hebrews absolutely believed that their God was all-powerful. And they absolutely believed that he was all-good. And that everything he created was also good. No question about it. They also believed that man was created in God's image. And what does that mean? That mean that we look like him? I don't think so. What it means is that we are self-aware. What it means is that we have a knowledge of good and evil and the ability to choose between the two. Ultimate understanding comes from this. As a result of our self-awareness, as a result of the image of God imprinted in us, we have the ability to choose. Necessarily so. What God did was choose the greater good in giving us the ability to love, which includes the ability to choose. It must have the freedom to choose in order for it to be love. He gave us the ability to love over the inability to create harm. He chose the greater good. Because by giving us the ability to choose harm, to choose evil, he gave us the ability to enter kingdom, to make choices like he makes choices, to become his hands and feet and his instruments on this earth. Evil is a necessary evil, I suppose you could look at it that way. It's an absolute necessity to our lives in the sense of if we're going to have the self-awareness, we've got to have the ability to choose unripely, unwisely, immaturely, until we can get to the point of maturity and start to see that there's a better choice to make. And if we pass that point and go to rottenness, that there still is a way back in letting all of that fall and die to replant the seed, to become born again, and to move back into that sweet spot where we can move back into relationship again. This is what it's all about. And so, the evil behavior, the evil circumstances we find ourselves in, the natural disasters that affect us and afflict us, are all those trials and temptations that are the means by which we are perfected, the means by which we are brought to complete fruition and ripeness. That's what James is talking about in his book. That's what Jesus was talking about. Lead us not into temptation. Don't let us be deviated. In fact, let these things ripen us. Let these things perfect us. And so the evil that is being done to us by immature people, unripe people, the things that happen out of nature that we call evil are still the things that we can use if we so choose to take us to completion. So when it comes right down to it, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Evil is as well. Evil has no meaning to us except in relationship to our response to it. How we react, how we respond to evil defines its place in our lives. If it further beats us down and takes us into a place of fear and separation, then it's truly evil in our lives. But if that difficult circumstance, let's call it, that hurtful perpetration on us by somebody else causes us to grow, to see beyond that, and to move another step toward maturity, then we can't hardly call it evil anymore in our lives. Some of the most beautiful things, some of the most, you know, large leaps of faith in the Spirit occurred in the most difficult circumstances. In Auschwitz, some of the writing that came out of the Jewish people there is absolutely profound. You know, we talk about sometimes that the church in the third world that is being persecuted, it seems to be so much stronger and so much more vibrant than our own because of the persecution. Well, no, not necessarily, but because of their reaction to it, because of their response to it. It grows them up. It makes them see that there's something beyond that which is just immediately in their presence, that there's something greater out there that they can react to. It's how we react to the difficulties, the evil, that makes all the difference. Some of you might have seen this. I just got this a couple of days ago through email, and it's just a story that I've got to read to you. And some of you might have seen it. Actually, I read it before, but it hit me a lot harder this time. And just sit and listen to this story. I think you'll... I haven't been able to read it in the last couple of days without breaking up, so I'm going to try to do it this time. See what you can do. At a fundraising dinner for a school that serves learning disabled children, the father of one of the students delivered a speech that would never be forgotten by all who attended. After extolling the school and its dedicated staff, he offered a question. When not interfered with by outside influences, everything nature does is done with perfection. Yet my son Shay cannot learn things as other children do. He cannot understand things as other children do. Where is the natural order of things in my son? The audience was stilled by the query. This is the evil. A son born with Down syndrome, a son born with a learning disability, a son born not ever going to be able to perform to normal human expectations, specifications. Most of us would see that as an evil, as a terrible, debilitating circumstance that befell us for no fault of our own. All right? The father continued, I believe that when a child like Shay, physically and mentally handicapped, comes into the world, an opportunity to realize true human nature presents itself. And it comes in the way other people treat that child. Then he told the following story. Shay and his father had walked past a park where some boys Shay knew were playing baseball. Shay asked, do you think they'll let me play? Shay's father knew that most of the boys would not want someone like Shay on their team, but the father also understood that if his son were allowed to play, it would give him a much-needed sense of belonging and some confidence to be accepted by others in spite of his handicaps. Shay's father approached one of the boys on the field and asked, not expecting much, if Shay could play. The boy looked around for guidance and said, well, we're losing by 6 runs and the game is in the 8th inning. I guess he can be on our team and we'll try to put him at bat in the 9th inning. Shay struggled over to the team's bench and with a broad smile put on a team shirt. His father watched with a small tear in his eye and warmth in his heart. The boys saw the father's joy at his son being accepted. In the bottom of the eighth inning, Shay's team scored a few runs but was still behind by three. In the top of the ninth inning, Shay put on a glove and played in the right field. Even though no hits came his way, he was obviously ecstatic just to be in the game and on the field, grinning from ear to ear as his father waved to him from the stands. In the bottom of the ninth inning, Shay's team scored again. Now with two outs and the bases loaded, the potential winning run was on base, and Shay was scheduled to be at bat. At this juncture, do they let Shay bat and give away their chance to win the game? Surprisingly, Shay was given the bat. Everyone knew that a hit was all impossible because Shay didn't even know how to hold the bat properly, much less connect with the ball. However, as Shay stepped up to the plate, the pitcher, recognizing that the other team was putting winning aside for this moment in Shay's life, moved in a few steps to lob the ball in softly so Shay could at least make contact. The first pitch came and Shay swung clumsily and missed. The pitcher again took a few steps forward to toss the ball softly towards Shay. As the pitch came in, Shay swung at the ball and hit a slow ground ball right back to the pitcher. The game would now be over. The pitcher picked up the soft grounder and could have easily thrown the ball to the first baseman. Shay would have been out, and that would have been the end of the game. Instead, the pitcher threw the ball high over the first baseman's head, out of reach of all teammates. Everyone from the stands and both teams started yelling, "Shay, run to first! Run to first!" Never in his life had Shay ever run that far. But he made it to first base. He scampered down the baseline, wide-eyed and startled. And everyone yelled, "Run to second! Run to second!" Catching his breath, Shay awkwardly ran towards second, gleaming and struggling to make it to the base. By the time Shay rounded towards second base, the right fielder had the ball. The smallest guy on their team, who now had his first chance to be the hero for his team. He could have thrown the ball to the second baseman for the tag, but he understood the pitcher's intention, so he, too, intentionally threw the ball high and far over the third baseman's head. Shay ran toward third base deliriously as the runners ahead of him circled the bases toward home. And all were screaming, "Shay, Shay, Shay, all the way, Shay!" Shay reached third base because the opposing shortstop ran to help him by turning him in the right direction toward third and shouted, "Run to third, Shay, run to third." As Shay rounded third, the boys from both teams and the spectators were on their feet screaming, "Shay, run home, run home." Shay ran to home, stepped on the plate, and was cheered as the hero who hit the grand slam and won the game for his team. "That day," said the father softly, with tears now rolling down his face, "the boys from both teams help bring a piece of true love and humanity into this world." Shay didn't make it to another summer. He died that winter, never having forgotten being the hero and making his father so happy and coming home and seeing his mother tearfully embrace her little hero of the day. There's a line in Genesis where Joseph tells his brothers, "What you meant for evil, God meant for good. In order to take us to this place, in order to preserve the life of many people, what you meant for evil, God meant for good." If we can keep our resolve firm, but our heart soft, if we can never seek to be right over being loving, if we can always preserve relationship instead of just following law, if we can resolve to protect the group without becoming blind to each other who creates the group, and if we can always protect each person without forsaking the needs of the group that shelters each individual, we can do this. We can live in an imperfect world. We can live in the presence of such evil that it takes our breath away. And we can find the way through. The way to overcome, the way to bring such incredible joy to somebody else that the evil is transformed by our presence there. That's what Jesus is trying to show us and teach us and tell us, and we can do it. It's not impossible. Let's pray. Father, thank you for a story like this one. So full of emotion and meaning, with the ability to show us more of the way than we might have been able to find on our own. And thank you for people in the world like this who can put aside everything that they're after in life for somebody else's joy. And please help us to be those people. Help us to become like that. Help us to see that anything that we think we want in life is nothing unless we can give this kind of joy to somebody else. And that everything we want in life is in the giving of a joy like that to somebody else. Help us to see your love and your way so clearly that it defines us and it becomes who we are as well, so that we can say with Jesus that we and the Father are one. And that anything that you see me do is only because the Father directed me first. That's our prayer, Lord. Help us to start right now, in this moment, in this day. And whenever we seem to lose our way, when we move into places of unripeness or rottenness, that you will bring us back to center, back to our sweet spot, Lord, in you. And we thank you. In Jesus' name. Amen. Let's stand. Circle up. Hey, our circle seems a little bigger today. Yeah, nice. I like it. Jeff, you want to lead us, buddy?
Sure. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Amen. Yay!